Hello, and thank you for joining this MedCast episode titled Treatment Strategies to Tackle NMIBC Heterogeneity. I'm Dr. Max Cates, a urologist and associate professor of urology and director of urologic oncology at the Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, Maryland.
Hi, everyone. I'm Neil Shore. I'm a urologist at the Carolina Urologic Research Center based in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina.
So today we really want to examine the disease heterogeneity in NMIBC and discuss how we tailor treatment strategies that both prioritize patients' quality of life and the effectiveness of some of our surgical strategies. Joining us in this conversation is Dr. Jennifer Linehan, Associate Professor of Urologic Oncology at Providence St. John's Cancer Institute in Santa Monica, California. Thanks so much for joining us, Jen. I really appreciate it. And really excited to hear your thoughts on some of these topics.
Thanks so much. Thanks, Dr. Cates and Dr. Shore. It is definitely an honor to be here with you guys. So, and excited to talk about non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, especially in the intermediate risk group, which I think is the hardest for us to treat and the hardest for us to sort of risk stratify about how we're going to, to tell the patients about their prognosis and what the next steps are. And now that there's so many options for treating non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, that in itself has made the problem a little bit more complex, not only for the doctors, but for the patients too.
Yeah, so, Neil's made this analogy before that when we think about heterogeneity, we typically have thought about prostate cancer and the complexity of disease around that. And I think we're starting to understand that bladder cancer and even low grade or intermediate risk bladder cancer, even within that, there's a diversity of the disease. And it's just curious how you risk stratify patients and how that risk stratification kind of influences the way you manage them.
Well, I think I really try to follow the, the AUAS UOL guidelines, which are a lot of those are in line with the NCCN guidelines too, as far as looking at these patients of, how many tumors do they have? How large are the tumors? Like, have they recurred before? Have they had low grade tumors that then have now become high grade tumors, or were they always high grade? And of course, I think one of the most important factors for us is there CIS at the time, when we're evaluating these patients? Because I think in my mind, especially that when the patients do have CIS, it takes it to a different level and really kicks it up into sort of the high risk profile. When I'm really thinking about intermediate risk, those are patients who either have low grade with large tumors over 3 centimeters, or maybe multifocal tumors where they have multiple tumors in the bladder, or they're the patients that, you treat their tumors, you do a TURBT, and you go back for your next cystoscopy and that there's already tumors there. So those are the patients that I'm really sticking in that intermediate risk group. And then also the patients who do have, smaller tumors that are high grade are also in that classification. But for me, really anyone with CIS, I kind of am kicking them up into the high grade. And I think that that's the problem. We don't always find the CIS, sometimes the first TURBT when we go in, and I depend a lot on my cytology to kind of give me that information.
Yeah, I mean, I think, one of the things, we've been struggling with is that we have these AUA-SUO guidelines that define intermediate risk as recurrent low-grade tumors or large low-grade tumors or multifocal low-grade tumors. And I'm with you. And then you have this oddity of a high-grade non-invasive tumor that's less than 3 centimeters. And, how do you navigate that? Do you kind of treat those patients differently than the low-grade tumors? And, and would love to hear your thoughts and then Neil's as well.
So I think for this is always a sticking point, right? Because for me, I also take into play, is this a recurrent high grade less than 3 centimeter tumor in this intermediate group? Is this patient still smoking? Do they have any other high risk factors? How old are they? Because that also plays in a role in what, I'm going to do as far as their treatment. But for the most part, any patients that I'm finding that have a high-grade lesion, even if it's a small one, I'm still going to recommend intravesical therapy. And at this point, you know, BCG or gemdosi, depending on whether I have BCG or not, are sort of my go-to starts.
Yeah, I would agree with Jennifer. I tend to treat with my pathologist says it's high grade. I tend to treat them as high grade, as if they were high risk. I think the two areas that cause some confusion amongst our colleagues is this less than 3 centimeter high grade and the low grade T1s. I don't know that I've ever really seen a low grade T1. I know a lot of our European colleagues have that in their EAU guidelines. I guess I'd be interested in Jennifer, how do you're in a teaching institution, and what are you doing right now to teach and measure accurately, you know, 3 centimeter versus greater than 3 centimeter? I think, unfortunately, you know, putting it bluntly, two things. One, I don't think urologists generalizably, or at least in the community, and maybe I don't know how well we do in academic centers, do a great job of really accurately measuring. But I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. And then we also, you know, plain speaking, we have a financial incentivization based upon reimbursement to go for the larger size. For right or wrong, you get a little bit better reimbursement if you're a large versus a smaller or intermediate size.
So I have an interesting practice here. This is sort of what we call privademics. So you're in this private practice, and it's kind of almost like a community urology group feel, but we also still have fellows that we're teaching. So I'm still a big fan of using one imaging, either using a CT urogram or an MRI of the pelvis too, to help me gauge, you know, the invasiveness of the tumors and the size of the tumors. So that will help me. But I also think I will, when I'm resecting and doing my TURBT, I will actually like take the tissue out, put the tissue down, and like sometimes measure to see how big the tumor slices are and kind of go off of that as well. And I also try to teach the fellows, please be very cognizant of making sure you send more biopsies, not just sending all of the bladder tissue together. Like, was there more than one tumor? Well, tell the pathologist that this came from the right lateral, the right posterior, or this was the base of the tumor. So because the more information they have, the more information that we will have, and that's going to help guide us in how we treat the patients.
Are you doing more and more on block resection cystoscopically for to make those measurements ex vivo more accurate?
So it's interesting that you said that. I just did a couple with the laser to see if I could help get a better estimate. And more, I was doing that to try to see if I could control bleeding, because we all know, you know, you're doing your TURBT, and as you're starting to cut through that tumor itself will start bleeding. So I was kept trying to use the laser to come under the tumor and see if I could avoid some of that, get an in-block resection, and then understand how much tumor I actually have. But I've only done about like 3 or 4 cases so far. So
I mean, I found, you know, intermediate risk is so fascinating, right? N-blocks are a perfect example. So you could have a 5 centimeter low grade tumor that you're diagnosing, and per the guidelines, that falls into intermediate risk based on size criteria alone. You know, especially if it's multifocal, if it's on a stalk, you know, you kind of lop it off, and really there's probably no difference than it being 1 centimeter or 2 centimeters. But if it's 4 or 5 centimeters because it's on the bladder, then that says something about sort of the field defect of that area of the bladder. So, you know, there's so many, and that's just one example within this disease space. So there's so many nuances, even within intermediate risk, that really make it just as much an art, you know, I think, as a science, and sort of trying to figure out how you're going to go about treating these patients. So within that context, you know, let's talk about the guidelines. You know, there's a couple things that the guidelines say that in the US, you know, urologists struggle with actually doing. One of them is perioperative chemotherapy after resecting low grade or intermediate risk tumors. The guidelines say that it should be discussed with the patient. And the other one is induction chemotherapy for intermediate risk tumors, which is also not routinely done. I've seen a statistic saying it's done less than 15% of the time. So just curious if why you view those as perhaps areas that where sort of maybe the guidelines are not adhered to as much, if you think that there are things we can do to sort of better adhere to those guidelines.
So the story that I have about that is, so we had a fellow come from a very big institution, and I was giving perioperative chemotherapy. And the fellow was like, "That's amazing. We can't do that at our institution." And I was like, "You come from this big place." But the hospital wouldn't pay for the perioperative chemotherapy. And I think that, like, you know, Dr. Shore, that goes to your point about cost too. Like, there are some other barriers outside of just taking good cancer care of patients that urologists, especially in the community, have to deal with. I've always done perioperative chemotherapy. I think there's very good data on gemcitabine that will help delay recurrence at least. And so I talk to all the patients about it. It's ordered on every, you know, TURBT that I have, that the staff already know that that's going to happen. And I am also like an early adopter of induction for any high grade tumor, even if they are smaller, because there's such a high rate of recurrence that's, you know, up to 70%. And so while the urologists out there know that those are the guidelines, I don't think everyone actually has access to that. And so that's something you have to fight for in your hospital. And for a lot of urologists, that's extra work, right?
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, there's that really wonderful SWOG study. I believe Seth Lerner was the PI on it, which clearly demonstrated that, you know, perioperative gemcitabine is of real value. But you hit great points. Sometimes it's a pure reimbursement issue, even though gemcitabine is generic and not very expensive. Sometimes it's throughput in your hospital ASC or an outpatient ASC in the community. Sometimes there are nursing regulations and concerns regarding just mixing a chemotherapy, and do you need a hood? Do you need special nursing requirements? It varies. It's a bit of the Wild West. It's tends to be all over. I think largely it can sometimes slow the post-op recovery process. But I think to your point, the data is overwhelming, but yet it's a minority of patients that do receive it. I think the data that I've seen, and it was a paper a few years back, Mike Cookson published, it was, you know, almost 40-50% of, quote, academic centers and maybe 10-15% of community-based centers. So sometimes the best cancer care gets obviated because of these other barriers. And I think that it makes for the complexity and sometimes the inefficiency of how we take care of these patients. And one of the things that's, you know, coming into the importance of the low-grade intermediate risk is there's this really very frothy pipeline of studies, really good quality trials to offer, if and when they do get approved, they're pending approvals, that could give us more opportunity, more tools in the toolbox, so to speak, to offer patients rather than repeat TURBTs, which I think we all know causes a lot, not just a lot of cost, but clearly morbidity for patients. So it'll be interesting to see how this evolves.
That's it.
Yeah, I couldn't.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was saying I couldn't agree more. I think that the perioperative chemotherapy issue is very different from the induction therapy issue. A perioperative chemotherapy, I think, you know, we have a paper out of JAMA by Messing showing, you know, clear differences with gemcitabine. I think there's much to be improved. Induction, you know, chemotherapy, for example, after a TURBT, with 6 weekly treatments for low grade recurrent disease, I think high grade is different. You know, that's a lot of treatment for a disease that's unlikely to progress. A lot of these patients, you know, Neil, you talk about the problems with TURBT, and a lot of these patients have a long recovery, and then you're going to give them more treatment, and it's probably worth it for high grade disease. There's a risk of progression. There's a risk of death from bladder cancer in those patients, but in low grade disease, that's not true. And so when we compound the problems of TURBT with an intravesical induction therapy, I think we have to be careful. So in my practice, I don't necessarily jump to induction chemotherapy for recurrent low-grade disease until I really think that, you know, we've got to pivot to something different. Like this is becoming a bigger problem than just, you know, the occasional resection or the occasional fulguration. But curious to know, you know, Jen, your thoughts as well.
I mean, so it begs the question, you know, if you look at the IVCG guidelines, you know, they sort of lump patients into anything that's low grade and anything that's high grade, which is easier for us to sort of risk stratify when we think about it that way. And the benefit of that is that you're really going to be treating, you know, well, you may be treating more patients that probably don't need extensive therapy. I mean, in bladder cancer, the problem is we tend to either undertreat sometimes or overtreat sometimes. And that's that group, that low grade group that you're talking about, because those are the patients, could we delay their TURBT? Could we just watch them again with cystoscopy before you do, you know, chemo induction? Could you just do fulguration in the office? Could you do something like UGN 102, where you may not even take those patients to TURBT, you just, you know, treat in the office? Or the other trial that we had here was the Belsar trial, which was the injecting, and, you know, we treated them right in the office. And then obviously in the study, we went back to do TURBT. But the thought was, if you could do things in the clinic, would it save those patients, you know, some hassle? And if you know they're not going to progress or need like an induction chemotherapy.
Yeah, I think a couple of those really important studies. There's others. I mean, this is a very exciting area. I think we would all agree that, you know, we have person power shortages in our ASCs and our hospital HOPD and getting OR time and, you know, our own clinics trying to move in and out of the patients who really need to be seen, who really need procedures, cystectomy, TURBT, and the muscle invasive. And I think, you know, as you're alluding to, if we can expand our armamentarium of options, particularly in the intermediate risk group, that needs a treatment, that doesn't need to just be on active surveillance, and there's that heterogeneity, that spectrum within intermediate risk, based on their, you know, their clinical parameters and their personal decision making, and you know, their number of tumors, their recurrence of tumors over time from their original TURBT. I think this is a great educational opportunity to help our colleagues say, assuming we get some approvals in 2025 and beyond, to expand, you know, that decision making.
Yeah, that's a great point. Let's kind of shift a little bit to, let's stick with low-grade recurrent bladder cancer. Curious, you know, how you approach the first recurrence versus sort of subsequent recurrences, how you talk to patients about sort of the first diagnosis of a low-grade tumor versus recurrences and your management.
I mean, I set the stage with, especially with low grade, you know, that listen, these are highly recurrent tumors. These are not life-threatening. You are very likely to get another recurrence, so that the patient is sort of not expecting that to happen, but they know that that's a high probability and that we'll treat that accordingly. And depending, you know, if you asked me 5 years ago what I did, I would tell you that every time I got a recurrence, I went back and I did a TURBT in the operating room. But I think because we know that that the rate of progression is so low in low grade patients, I've been a lot more willing to treat in the office, do, you know, delayed TURBT. Well, okay, you have a couple of tumors, I'll fulgurate. I'll always biopsy if I am going to fulgurate in the office. And then, you know, send that off and then kind of bring them back in another 3 months and recheck everything. And I think, you know, earlier in my career, I was sort of less willing to do that because I didn't want to miss anything. But I think in a lot of these low grade patients, that is a very reasonable strategy. And I mean, we don't even have OR time if I wanted to take half of these patients to the operating room. So I think, you know, understanding that this with low grade, that even though that they are considered intermediate risk by some of the guidelines, I think those patients can still be managed more conservatively than we have been in the last, you know, 10 years.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I mean, look, Mark Soloway for years was telling everybody, you can just watch these patients or biopsy and fulgurate them in the clinic. And I'm like you, Jennifer, you know, in the beginning, when I was like, oh man, I got to schedule you for a TURBT. I do so many more biopsy fulgurations now in the clinic with flexible scope, camera, patients seeing what's going on, or even occasionally a rigid if I need to. And then it's a much better throughput. It's a lot more efficient. And then two, I'm so much more comfortable in saying, look, we've had biopsy. I'm really confident this is low grade intermediate risk, one or two lesions, not carpeting. Maybe the patient has some other comorbidities, fragility or anesthesia risks. I just watch those patients. But I think that active surveillance and just maybe monitoring with urine analyses and or if there's a urine biomarker you're comfortable with is still a very underutilized strategy in the U.S.
Yeah, I don't know about, I'd like to hear from both of you about the urine biomarkers because I do use them, but I don't always trust them. I still will convert to cystoscopy.
Yeah, I mean, so with the disease space we're talking about, I don't find urine cytology particularly helpful. Urine cytology just in general is so dependent on a cytopathologist that sort of you trust, respect, and work with, because otherwise the atypia and suspicious calls will go up and your negative calls will go down. And then you're left with a very challenging discussion with the patient with a result that's not quite positive and not quite negative. And what do you make of it? So, you know, clearly, I think there's an unmet need for urine biomarkers for low grade disease, and for high grade disease, because honestly, if we can accurately understand if a tumor is high grade versus low grade, then we will feel more comfortable not taking a patient for a TURBT and not overtreating, potentially. But even, you know, having said that, aside from active surveillance, you know, there's many patients that probably active surveillance is not ideal for that we're treating. And, you know, at what point do you say, okay, I want to do an adjuvant therapy? And what's your sense of how well it's going to work?
I mean, for my practice, it's really based on the multifocality of the tumors, how many tumors they have, and how fast they're recurring. I mean, we've all had these patients that you do the TURBT and in less than 3 months, they have more tumors. And then the next time you go back again, and maybe you fulgurate or do, you know, something in the office, and you come back again, and then you're starting to see like a carpet of these little tumors on the dome of the bladder. And, you know, they continue to progress. And I think that those are the patients where every time I see them, I'm either having to biopsy or fulgurate or something else that I'm really starting to think about adjuvant therapy. Now, for me, for low grade, my go-to is mitomycin. I still think the data is very good. I mean, definitely not, you know, BCG, although I've heard of people doing that and I know they do that in Europe as well. But I think mitomycin or gemcitabine have been sort of been my first go-tos in that space.
Yeah, that was a really good description of the patients who you'd want to treat. And of course, with the BCG shortage, which less of an issue outside of the U.S. as it is in the U.S., you know, it's still rearing itself. I think, you know, intravesical chemotherapy clearly can play a role. And you know, you have to think about really, you know, there are always these other issues on affordability and access for that. But I do think that it's an interesting discussion to have with patients is, you know, do they want to come in for treatment? You know, is it tolerable? And the answer is it is, you know, for the vast majority of these patients. And I think it's really individualizing and getting that right selection, as you point out, Jennifer.
Yeah, that's very well said. So in the few minutes that we have left, would love to hear just what both of you are excited about in terms of intermediate risk disease. I think we've touched on it a little bit, but we'd just love to hear your thoughts in the let's cap the years. Let's say in the next 3 to 5 years.
So in the next 3 to 5 years, I'm very much looking forward to your study results, the Bridge trial. I think that that's going to be exceptional. I think the BCG naive space is what I'm most excited about. And then I think for low grade tumors, like I talked about UGN-101 or Bel-sar or treatments that we can do in the clinic with the patients that'll kind of keep them out of the OR and also keep them from recurring. So those are the two areas, the BCG naive and sort of the in-house treatments that I can do without having to go OR for low to having to go to the OR for low grade patients.
Yeah, I'm so happy you brought up the Bridge trial. Let Max talk about that and to finish. But I agree with you. There's a whole host of really interesting clinic-based treatment options from the Bel-sar with Aura Biosciences and the Urogen UGN-102. And then also a lot of the products that we already have approved in the high-risk BCG unresponsive are naturally now looking at the intermediate risk group too, inclusive of at Adstiladrin, inclusive of CG Oncology's cretostimogene, which is not yet approved, and also not yet approved, but looking at the intermediate risk group or the TAR 200 and the TAR 210, that device, drug releasing device that has either embedded, incorporated gemcitabine or erdafitinib. So, and then there's others too. That's what I'm excited about. And I think that the field of bladder cancer, not just in NMIBC, BCG unresponsive CIS, where we've seen great recent approvals, but now in BCG high risk and in intermediate risk. And then of course, in our muscle invasive patients and our metastatic frontline, second line, we're seeing exceptional advances, which I think speaks to the importance. I like, how did you phrase it? You have pribademics. That's a cool word. I don't think I'd heard that before, but you know, we are blending more and more the really high level importance of the model of academia, getting it into the community so that there really are more centers of excellence, however you want to define that. And then the North Star being the patients get the best care.
Yeah. And I'm also, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's so well said. Jen, would love to hear your thoughts as well.
And I am just, you know, a big, you know, proponent of clinical trials. And so I'm lucky enough to live in, you know, Los Angeles, where I may not have a clinical trial, but there are plenty of other places that do. And I do push patients, like BCG naive, if I don't have BCG, I will push them to go to other places for trials. And I know there's always some fear that people are worried about losing patients, but let me tell you, if you send a patient to another investigator, they are going to want you to send more patients. Like, you're not going to lose that patient. And so I think there's enough trials around that we really need to understand more. And so I always encourage my patients to go to some of these trials in the local area. And I will have patients that will come see me to say, okay, what trial should I go to next? I've now earned this reputation with patients as well. So, but I think it's like a very exciting time for, you know, non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. And we have thank God the patients have a lot of options.
Yeah, I would just, you know, close with saying I couldn't agree with more with both of you. I mean, if we look at the past, where basically we had in our toolkit TURBT and BCG, and we look at the present where we now have, you know, 4 to 5 new drugs approved for various types of non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, and then we kind of look into the future, specifically of intermediate risk, where we're actually talking about sort of decreasing the surgical burden of the disease. I mean, we're always going to have a TURBT, but when we do a cystectomy, we view a recurrence as, you know, a terrible thing. And the same should be true when we do a TURBT. A recurrence in the bladder should not be expected. And so You know, I will only want to do one or two TURBTs on a patient in their lifetime. And I think that in the future, we're really going to have therapies, you know, ablative therapies, adjuvant therapies, you name it. We're going to have it in our toolkit to be able to reduce that burden for our patients. So this was a lot of fun talking to both of you. Thank you so much for joining us.